Dreamscape presents Forever Interrupted by Taylor Jenkins Reid, narrated by Tara Sands. Every morning when I wake up, I forget for a fraction of a second that you are gone and I reach for you. All I ever find is the cold side of the bed. My eyes settle on the picture of us in Paris on the bedside table, and I am overjoyed that even though the time was brief, I loved you, and you loved me. Craigslist posting, Chicago, 2009. Part 1. June.
Have you decided if you're going to change your name? Ben asks me. He is sitting on the opposite end of the couch, rubbing my feet.
He looks so cute. How did I end up with someone so goddamn cute?
I have an idea, I tease. But I have more than an idea. My face breaks into a smile. I think I'm gonna do it.
Really?
He asks excitedly. Would you want that? I ask him.
Are you kidding?
He says.
I mean, you don't have to. If you feel like it's offensive or, I don't know, if it negates your own name, I want you to have the name you want,
he says.
But if that name happens to be my name,
he blushes slightly.
That might be really cool.
He seems too sexy to be a husband. You think of husbands as fat, balding men who take out the trash. But my husband is sexy. He's young and he's tall and he's strong. He's so perfect.
I sound like an idiot, but this is how it's supposed to be, right? As a newlywed, I'm supposed to see him through these rose-colored glasses.
I was thinking of going by Elsie Porter Ross, I say to him.
He stops rubbing my feet for a minute. That's really hot,
he says.
I laugh at him.
Why?
I don't know, he says, starting to rub my feet again. It's probably some weird caveman thing. I just like the idea that we are the Rosses. We are Mr. and Mrs. Ross.
I like that, I say. Mr. and Mrs. Ross. That is hot.
I told you.
That settles it. As soon as the marriage certificate gets here, I'm sending it to the DMV or wherever you have to send it.
Awesome,
he says, taking his hands off of me.
Okay, Elsie Porter Ross, my turn.
I grab his feet. It's quiet for a while as I absentmindedly rub his toes through his socks. My mind wanders, and after some time it lands on a startling realization. I am hungry.
Are you hungry?
I ask.
No.
I really want to get Fruity Pebbles for some reason.
We don't have cereal here?
Ben asks. No, we do. I want Fruity Pebbles.
We have adult cereals, boxes of brown shapes fortified with fiber.
Well, should we go get some?
I'm sure CVS is still open, and I'm sure they sell Fruity Pebbles. Or I could go get them for you.
No, I can't let you do that. That would be so lazy of me.
That is lazy of you, but you're my wife, and I love you, and I want you to have what you want.
He starts to get up.
No, really, you don't have to. I'm going.
Ben leaves the room briefly and returns with his bike and shoes.
Thank you, I say, now lying across the sofa, taking up the space he just abandoned.
Ben smiles at me as he opens the front door and walks his bike through it. I can hear him put the kickstand down, and I know he will come back in to say goodbye.
I love you, Elsie Porter Ross,
he says, and he bends down to the couch to kiss me. He is wearing a bike helmet and bike gloves. He grins at me.
I really love the sound of that.
I smile wide. I love you, I say to him. Thank you.
You're welcome. I love you. I'll be right back.
He shuts the door behind him.
I lay my head back down and pick up a book, but I can't concentrate.
I miss him. 20 minutes pass, and I start to expect him home, but the door doesn't open. I don't hear anyone on the steps. Once 30 minutes have passed, I call his cell phone. No answer. My mind starts to race with possibilities. They are all far-fetched and absurd. He met someone else. He stopped off at a strip club. I call him again as my brain starts to think of more realistic reasons for him to be late. Reasons that are reasonable and thus far more terrifying. When he does not answer again, I get off the couch and walk outside. I'm not sure what I expect to find, but I look up and down the street for any sign of him. Is it crazy to think he's hurt? I can't decide. I try to stay calm and tell myself that he must just be stuck in some sort of traffic jam that he can't get out of, or maybe he's run into an old friend. The minutes start to slow. They feel like hours. Each second passing is an insufferable period of time. Sirens. I can hear sirens heading in my direction. I can see their flashing lights just above the rooftops on my street. Their whooping alarms sound like they are calling to me. I can hear my name in their repetitive wailing. Elsie, Elsie. I start running. By the time I get to the end of my street, I can feel just how cold the concrete is on the balls of my feet. My light sweatpants are no match for the wind, but I keep going until I find the source. I see two ambulances and a fire truck. There are a few police cars barricading the area. I run as far into the fray as I can get before I stop myself. Someone is being lifted onto a stretcher. There's a large moving truck flipped over on the side of the road. Its windows are smashed, glass surrounding it. I look closely at the truck, trying to figure out what happened. That's when I see that it isn't all glass. The road is covered in little specks of something else. I walk closer and I see one at my feet. It's a fruity pebble. I scan the area for the one thing I pray not to see, and I see it. Right in front of me. How could I have missed it? Halfway underneath the moving truck is Ben's bike. It's bent and torn. The world goes silent. The sirens stop. The city comes to a halt. My heart starts beating so quickly it hurts in my chest. I can feel the blood pulsing through my brain. It's so hot out here. When did it get so hot outside? I can't breathe. I don't think I can breathe. I'm not breathing. I don't even realize I am running until I reach the ambulance doors. I start to pound on them. I jump up and down as I try to pound on the window that is too high above me to reach. As I do, all I hear is the sound of the fruity pebbles crunching beneath my feet. I grind them into the pavement each time I jump. I break them into a million pieces. The ambulance pulls away. Is he in it? Is Ben in there? Are they keeping him alive? Is he okay? Is he bruised? Maybe he's in the ambulance because protocol says they have to, but he's actually fine. Maybe he's around here somewhere. Maybe the ambulance was holding the driver of the car. That guy has to be dead, right? No way that person survived. So Ben must be all right. That's the karma of an accident. The bad guy dies, the good guy lives. I turn around, but I don't see Ben anywhere. I start to scream his name. I know he's okay, I'm sure of it. I just need this to be over. I just want to see him with a small scrape and be told he's fine to go home. Let's go home, Ben. I've learned my lesson to never let you do such a stupid favor for me again. I've learned my lesson. Let's go home. Ben! I shout into the nighttime air. It's so cold. How did it get so cold? Ben! I shout again. I feel like I am running in circles until I am stopped in my place by a police officer. Ma'am, he says as he grabs my arms. I keep shouting. Ben needs to hear me. He needs to know that I am here. He needs to know that it's time to come home. Ma'am, the officer calls again. What? I yell into his face. I rip my arms out of his grasp and I spin myself around. I try to run through what is clearly a marked-off area. I know that whoever marked this off would want to let me through. They would understand that I just need to find my husband. The officer catches up to me and grabs me again. Ma'am, he says, this time more severe. You cannot be here right now. Doesn't he understand that this is exactly where I must be right now? I need to find my husband, I say to him. He could be hurt. That's his bike. I have to find him. Ma'am, they have taken your husband to Cedar Sinai. Do you have a ride to get there? My eyes are staring at his face, but I do not understand what he is saying to me. Where is he? I ask. I need him to tell me again.
I don't understand. Ma'am, your husband is on his way to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. He is being rushed to the emergency room. Would you like me to take you?
He's not here? I think. He was in that ambulance?
Is he okay?
Ma'am, I can't.
Is he okay?
The police officer looks at me. He pulls his hat off his head and places it on his chest.
I know what this means. I've seen it done on the doorsteps of war widows in period pieces.
As if on cue, I start violently heaving.
I need to see him! I scream through my tears. I need to see him! I need to be with him!
I drop to my knees in the middle of the road, cereal crunching underneath me.
Is he all right? I should be with him. Just tell me if he is still alive.
The police officer looks at me with pity and guilt. I've never seen the two looks together before, but it's easy to recognize.
Ma'am, I'm sorry. Your husband has...
The police officer isn't rushed. He isn't running on adrenaline like me. He knows there is nothing to hurry for. He knows my husband's dead body can wait. I don't let him finish his sentence. I know what he's going to say, and I can't believe it. I won't believe it. I scream at him, pounding my fists into his chest. He is a huge man, probably 6'4" at least, and he looms over me. I feel like a child, but that doesn't stop me. I just keep flailing and hitting him. I want to slap him. I want to kick him. I want to make him hurt like I do.
He passed away on impact. I'm sorry.
That's when I fall to the ground. Everything starts spinning. I can hear my pulse, but I can't focus on what the policeman is saying. I really didn't think this was going to happen. I thought bad things only happened to people with hubris. They don't happen to people like me, people that know how fragile life is, people that respect the authority of a higher power. But it has. It has happened to me. My body calms. My eyes dry. My face freezes and my gaze falls onto a scaffolding and stays there. My arms feel numb. I'm not sure if I'm standing or sitting.
What happened to the driver? I ask the officer, calm and composed.
I'm sorry?
What happened to the person driving the moving truck?
He passed away, ma'am.
Good, I say to him.
I say it like a sociopath. The police officer just nods his head at me, perhaps indicating some unspoken contract that he will pretend he didn't hear me say it, and I can pretend I don't wish another person to have died. But I don't want to take it back. He grabs my hand and leads me into the front of his police car. He uses his siren to break through traffic, and I see the streets of Los Angeles in fast forward. They have never looked so ugly. When we get to the hospital, the officer sits me down in the waiting room. I'm shaking so hard that the chair shakes with me.
I need to go back there, I say to him. I need to go back there,
I yell louder. I take notice of his name tag, Officer Hernandez.
I understand. I'm going to find out all of the information that I can. I believe you will have a social worker assigned to you. I'll be right back.
I can hear him talking, but I can't make myself react or acknowledge him. I just sit in the chair and stare at the far wall. I can feel my head sway from side to side. I feel myself stand and walk toward the nurse's station, but I am cut off by Officer Hernandez coming back. He is now with a short, middle-aged man. The man has on a blue shirt with a red tie. I bet this idiot calls it his power tie. I bet he thinks he has a good day when he wears this tie.
Elsie,
he says. I must have told Officer Hernandez my name. I don't even remember doing that. He puts out his hand as if I were going to shake it. I see no need for formality in the midst of tragedy. I let it hang there. Before all this, I would never have rejected someone's handshake. I am a nice person. Sometimes I'm even a pushover. I'm not someone who is considered difficult or unruly.
You are the wife of Ben Ross? Do you have a driver's license on you?
The man asks me. No, I ran right out of the house. I look down at my feet. I don't even have on shoes, and this man thinks I have my driver's license?
Officer Hernandez leaves. I can see him step away slowly, awkwardly. He feels like his job is done here, I'm sure. I wish I was him. I wish I could walk away from this and go home. I'd go home to find my husband and a warm bed. My husband, a warm bed, and a fucking bowl of Fruity Pebbles.
I'm afraid we cannot let you back there yet, Elsie,
the man in the red tie says. Why not?
The doctors are working.
He's alive? I scream. How quickly hope can come flying back.
No, I'm sorry.
He shakes his head.
Your husband died earlier this evening. He was listed as an organ donor.
I feel like I'm in an elevator that is plummeting to the ground floor. They are taking pieces of him and giving them to other people. They are taking his parts. I sit back down in the chair, dead inside. Part of me wants to scream at this man to let me back there, to let me see him. I want to run through the twin doors and find him, hold him. What are they doing to him? But I'm frozen. I am dead too. The man in the red tie leaves briefly and comes back with hot chocolate and slippers. My eyes are dry and tired. I can barely see through them. All of my senses feel muted. I feel trapped in my own body, separated from everyone around me.
Do you have someone we can call? Your parents?
I shake my head. Anna, I say. I should call Anna. He puts his hand on my shoulder.
Can you write down Anna's number? I'll call her.
I nod and he hands me a piece of paper and a pen. It takes me a minute to remember her number. I write it down wrong a few times before I write it down correctly, but I'm pretty sure when I hand over the piece of paper, it's the correct number. What about Ben? I ask. I don't know what exactly I mean. I can't give up yet. I can't be at the call someone to take her home and watch her phase yet. We have to fight this, right? I have to find him and save him. How can I find him and save him?
The nurses have called the next of kin.
What? I'm his next of kin.
Apparently his driver's license listed an address in Orange County. We had to legally notify his family.
So who did you call? Who is coming? But I already know who's coming.
I will see if I can find out. I'm going to go phone Anna. I'll be back shortly, okay?
I nod. In this lobby, I can see and hear other families waiting. Some look somber, but most look okay. There is a mother with her young daughter. They are reading a book. There is a young boy holding an ice pack to his face next to a father who seems annoyed. There is a teenage couple holding hands. I don't know why they are here, but judging from the smiles on their faces and the way they are flirting, I can only assume it's not dire, and I want to scream at them. I want to say that emergency rooms are for emergencies, and they shouldn't be here if they are going to look happy and carefree. I want to tell them to go home and be happy somewhere else because I don't need to see it. I don't remember what it feels like to be them. I don't even remember how it feels to be myself before this happened. All I have is this overwhelming sense of dread. That and my anger toward these two little shitheads who won't get their smiles out of my fucking face. I hate them, and I hate the goddamn nurses who just go on with their day like it isn't the worst one of their lives. They make phone calls, and they make photocopies, and they drink coffee. I hate them for being able to drink coffee at a time like this. I hate everyone in this entire hospital for not being miserable. The man in the red tie comes back and says that Anna is on her way. He offers to sit down and wait with me. I shrug. He can do whatever he wants. His presence brings me no solace, but it does prevent me from running up to someone and screaming at them for eating a candy bar at a time like this. My mind flashes back to the Fruity Pebbles all over the road, and I know they will be there when I get home. I know that no one will have cleaned them up because no one could possibly know how horrifying they would be to look at again. Then I think of what a stupid reason that is for Ben to die. He died over Fruity Pebbles. It would be funny if it wasn't so. It will never be funny. Nothing about this is funny. Even the fact that I lost my husband because I had a craving for a children's cereal based on the Flintstones cartoon. I hate myself for this. That's who I hate the most. Anna shows up in a flurry of panic. I don't know what the man in the red tie has told her. He stands to greet her as she runs toward me. I can see them talking, but I can't hear them. They speak only for a second before she runs to my side, puts her arms around me. I let her arms fall where she puts them, but I have no energy to hug back. This is the dead fish of hugs. She whispers, "I'm sorry," into my ear, and I crumble into her arms. I have no will to hold myself up, no desire to hide my pain. I wail in the waiting room. I sob and heave into her breasts. Any other moment of my life, I'd move my head away from that part of her body. I'd feel uncomfortable with my eyes and lips being that close to a sexual body part, but right now, sex feels trivial and stupid. It feels like something idiots do out of boredom. Those happy teenagers probably do it for sport. Her arms around me don't comfort me. The water springs from my eyes as if I'm forcing it out, but I'm not. It's just falling on its own. I don't even feel sad. This level of devastation is so far beyond tears that mine feel paltry and silly.
Have you seen him, Elsie? I'm so sorry.
I don't answer. We sit on the floor of the waiting room for what seems like hours. Sometimes I wail. Sometimes I feel nothing. Most of the time I lie in Anna's arms. Not because I need to, but because I don't want to look at her. Eventually, Anna gets up and rests me against the wall, and then she walks up to the nurse's station and starts yelling. "How much longer until we can see Ben Ross?" she screams at the young Latina nurse sitting at her computer. "Ma'am," the nurse says, standing up. But Anna moves away from her. "No, don't ma'am me. Tell me where he is. Let us through." The man in the red tie makes his way over to her and tries to calm her down. He and Anna speak for a few minutes, and I can see him try to touch Anna, to console her, and she jerks her shoulder out of his reach. He is just doing his job. Everyone here is just doing their job. What a bunch of assholes. I see an older woman fly through the front doors. She looks about 60, with long reddish-brown hair and waves around her face. She has mascara running down her cheeks, a brown purse over her shoulder, a blackish-brown shawl across her chest. She has tissues in her hands. I wish my grief were composed enough to have tissues. I've been wiping snot on my sleeves and neckline. I've been letting tears fall into puddles on the floor. She runs up to the front desk and then resigns herself to sit. When she turns to face me briefly, I know exactly who she is. I stare at her. I can't take my eyes off of her. She is my mother-in-law. A stranger, by all accounts. I saw her picture a few times in a photo album, but she has never seen my face. I remove myself and head into the bathroom. I do not know how to introduce myself to her. I do not know how to tell her that we are both here for the same man, that we are both grieving over the same loss. I stand in front of the mirror and I look at myself. My face is red and blotchy. My eyes are bloodshot. I look at my face and I think that I had someone who loved this face, and now he's gone. And now no one loves my face anymore. I step back out of the bathroom and she is gone. I turn to find Anna grabbing my arm.
"You can go in," she says, and leads me to the man in the red tie, who leads me through the double doors.
The man in the red tie stops outside a room and asks me if I want him to go in with me. Why would I want him to go in with me? I just met this man. This man means nothing to me. The man inside this room means everything to me.
Nothing isn't going to help losing everything.
I open the door, and there are other people in the room, but all I can see is Ben's body.
"Excuse me?" my mother-in-law says through her tears.
It is meek, but terrifying. I ignore it.
I grab his face in my hands, and it's cold to the touch. His eyelids are shut. I'll never see his eyes again. It occurs to me they might be gone.
I can't look. I don't want to figure it out. His face is bruised, and I don't know what that means. Does that mean he was hurt before he died? Did he die there alone and lonely on the street? Oh my God, did he suffer? I feel faint. There's a sheet over his chest and legs. I'm scared to move the sheet. I'm scared that there is too much of Ben exposed, too much of him to see. Or that there is too much of him that is gone. Security! She calls out into the air. As I hold on to Ben's hand, and a security guard shows up at the door, I look at my mother-in-law. She has no reason to know who I am. She has no reason to understand what I am doing here, but she has to know I love her son. That much has to be obvious by now. Please, I beg her. Please, Susan, don't do this. Susan looks at me curiously, confused. By the sheer fact that I know her name, she knows she must be missing something. She very subtly nods and looks at the security guard. I'm sorry. Give us a moment. He leaves the room, and Susan looks at the nurse. You too. Thank you. The nurse leaves the room, shutting the door. Susan looks tortured, terrified, and yet composed, as if she has only enough poise to get through the next 5 seconds and then she will fall apart. His hand has a wedding ring on it, she says to me. I stare at her and try to keep breathing. I meekly lift up my own left hand to match. We were married a week and a half ago, I say through tears. I can feel the corners of my lips pulling down. They feel so heavy. What is your name? She asks me, now shaking. Elsie, I say. I am terrified of her. She looks angry and vulnerable, like a teenage runaway. Elsie what? She chokes. Elsie Ross. That's when she breaks. She breaks, just like I have. Soon she's on the floor. There are no more tissues in sight to save the linoleum from her tears. Anna is sitting next to me, holding my hand. I am sitting next to Ben's side, sobbing. Susan excused herself some time ago. The man in the red tie comes in and says we need to clear some things up and Ben's body needs to be moved. I just stare ahead. I don't even focus on what's happening until the man in the red tie hands me a bag of Ben's things. His cell phone is in there, his wallet, his keys. What is this? I ask, even though I know what it is. Before the man in the red tie can answer me, Susan appears in the doorway. Her face is strained. Her eyes are bloodshot. She looks older than she did when she left. She looks exhausted. Do I look like that? I bet I look like that. What are you doing? Susan asks the man.
We need to clear the room. Your son's body is going to be transferred.
Why are you giving that to her? Susan says more directly. She says it like I'm not even here.
I'm sorry?
Susan steps further into the room and takes the bag of Ben's stuff from in front of me. All decisions about Ben, all his belongings, should be directed to me, she says.
Ma'am,
the man in the red tie says. All of it, she says. Anna stands up and grabs me to go with her. She intends to remove me from this situation, and while I don't want to be here right now, I can't just be removed. I pull my arm out of Anna's hand and I look at Susan. Should we discuss what the next steps are? I say to her. What is there to discuss? Susan says. She is cold and controlled. I just mean... I don't actually know what I mean.
Mrs. Ross,
the man in the red tie says. Yes? Both Susan and I answer at the same time. I'm sorry, I say. Which one did you mean?
The elder,
he says, looking at Susan. I'm sure that he meant it as a sign of respect, but it's torn right through her. Susan doesn't want to be one of two Mrs. Rosses, that much is clear. But I bet she resents even more being the elder one. I'm not going to give this any more credence, she says to everyone in the room. She has absolutely no proof that my son even knew her, let alone married her. I've never heard of her. My own son. I saw him last month. He never mentioned a damn thing, so no, I'm not having my son's possessions sent home with a stranger. I won't have it. Anna reaches towards Susan.
Maybe it's time for us all to take a step back, she says.
Susan turns her head, as if noticing Anna for the first time.
Who are you? She asks.
She asks it like we are clowns coming out of a Volkswagen. She asks it as if she's exhausted by all the people that keep appearing.
I'm a friend, Anna says, and I don't think any of us are in a position to behave rationally, so maybe we can just breathe.
Susan turns toward the man in the red tie, her body language interrupting Anna mid-sentence.
You and I need to discuss this in private, she barks at him.
Ma'am, please calm down.
Calm down? You're joking.
Susan, I start to say. I don't know how I planned on finishing, but Susan doesn't give a shit.
Stop, she says, putting her hand up in my face. It's aggressive and instinctual, as if she needs to protect her face from my words.
Ma'am, Elsie was escorted in by the police. She was at the scene. I have no reason to doubt that she and your son were, as she says,
married?
Susan is incredulous.
Yes,
the man in the red tie says.
Call the county. I want to see a record of it.
Elsie, do you have a copy of your marriage certificate that you can show Mrs. Ross?
I can feel myself shrinking in front of them. I don't want to shrink. I want to stand tall. I want to be proud, confident. But this is all too much, and I don't have anything to show for myself.
No, but Susan, I say, as tears fall down my face.
I feel so ugly right now, so small and stupid.
Stop calling me that, she screams. You don't even know me. Stop calling me by my name.
Fine, I say. My eyes are staring forward, focused on the body in the room. My husband's body.
Keep all of it, I say. I don't care. We can sit here and scream all day, but it doesn't change anything. So I really don't give a shit where his wallet goes.
I put one foot in front of the other and I walk out. I leave my husband's body there with her, and the minute my feet hit the hallway, the minute Anna has shut the door behind us, I regret walking out. I should have stayed with him until the nurse kicked me out. Anna pushes me forward. She puts me in the car. She buckles my seatbelt. She drives slowly through town. She parks in my driveway. I don't remember any of it happening. Suddenly, I am at my front door. Stepping into my apartment, I have no idea what time of day it is. I have no idea how long it has been since I sat on the couch like a cavalier bitch whining about cereal in my pajamas. This apartment, the one I have loved since I moved in, the one I considered ours when Ben moved in, now betrays me. It hasn't moved an inch since Ben died. It's like it doesn't care. It didn't put away his shoes sitting in the middle of the floor. It didn't fold up the blanket he was using. It didn't even have the decency to hide his toothbrush from plain view. This apartment is acting like nothing has changed. Everything has changed. I tell the walls he's gone. He's dead. He's not coming home. Anna rubs my back and says, I know, baby. I know. She doesn't know. She could never know. I walk carelessly into my bedroom, hit my shoulder on the door hinge, and feel nothing. I get into my side of the bed, and I can smell him still. He's still here in the sheets. I grab his pillow from his side of the bed, and I smell it, choking on my own tears. I walk into the kitchen as Anna is getting me a glass of water. I walk right past her with the pillow in my hand and I grab a trash bag, shoving the pillow into it. I tie it tight, knotting the plastic over and over until it breaks off in my hand and falls onto the kitchen floor. What are you doing? She asks me. It smells like Ben, I answer. I don't want the smell to evaporate. I want to save it. I don't know if that's going to work, she says delicately.
Fuck you, I say, and go back to the bed. I start crying the minute I hit my pillow. I hate what this has made me. I've never told anyone to fuck off before, least of all Anna.
Anna has been my best friend since I was 17 years old. We met the first day of college in line at the dining hall. I didn't have anyone to sit with, and she was already trying to avoid a boy. It was a telling moment for each of us. When she decided to move to Los Angeles to be an actress, I came with her. Not because I had any affinity for Los Angeles. I had never been here. But because I had such a strong affinity for her. Anna had said to me, "Come on, you can be a librarian anywhere." And she was absolutely right. Here we were, 9 years after meeting, her watching me like I'm going to slit my wrists. If I had a better grip on my senses, I'd say this is the real meat of friendship. But I don't care about that right now. I don't care about anything. Anna comes in with two pills and a glass of water. "I found these in your medicine cabinet," she says. I look in her hand and I recognize them. It's Vicodin from when Ben had a back spasm last month. He barely took any of them. I think he thought taking them made him a wimp. I take them out of her hand without questioning, and I swallow them. "Thank you," I say. She tucks the duvet around me and goes to sleep on the couch. I'm glad she doesn't try to sleep in bed with me. I don't want her to take away his smell. My eyes are parched from crying. My limbs weak, but my brain needs the Vicodin to pass out. I shuffle over to Ben's side of the bed as I get groggy and fall asleep. "I love you," I say. And for the first time, there's no one to hear it. I wake up, feeling hungover. I reach over to grab Ben's hand as I do every morning, and his side of the bed is empty. For a minute, I think he must be in the bathroom or making breakfast, and then I remember. My devastation returns, this time duller but thicker, coating my body like a blanket, sinking my heart like a stone. I pull my hands to my face and try to wipe away the tears, but they are flowing out of me too fast to catch up. It's like a whack-a-mole of misery. Anna comes in with a dish towel in her hands, drying them. "You're up," she says, surprised. How observant. Why am I being so mean? I'm not a mean person. This isn't who I am. "Susan called." She is ignoring my outbursts, and for that I am thankful. "What did she say?" I sit up and grab the glass of water on my bedside table from last night. What could she possibly want from me?
"She didn't say anything, just to call her."
"Great.
I left the number on the refrigerator, in case you did want to call her."
"Thanks."
I sip the water and stand up. "I have to go walk Bugsy, and then I'll be right back," Anna says. Bugsy is her English bulldog. He drools all over everything, and I want to tell her that Bugsy doesn't need to be let out because Bugsy is a lazy sack of shit. But I don't say any of this because I really, really want to stop being so unkind.
"Okay. Do you want anything while I'm out?" she asks. And it reminds me that I asked Ben to get me Fruity Pebbles. I get right back into bed.
"No, nothing for me. Thank you."
"Okay, I'll be back shortly."
She thinks for a minute.
"Actually, do you want me to stick around in case you decide to call her now?"
"No, thanks, I can handle it."
"Okay, if you change your mind, thanks."
Anna leaves, and as I hear the door shut, it hits me how alone I am. I am alone in this room. I am alone in this apartment. But more to the point, I am alone in this life. I can't even wrap my brain around it. I just get up and pick up the phone. I get the number from the front of the refrigerator, and I see a magnet for Georgie's Pizza. I fall to the floor, my cheek against the cold tile. I can't seem to make myself get up.
December. It was New Year's Eve, and Anna and I had this great plan. We were going to this party to see this guy she had been flirting with at the gym, and then we were going to leave at 11:30 p.m. We wanted to drive to the beach, open a bottle of champagne together, and ring in the new year tipsy and drenched in sea spray. Instead, Anna got too drunk at the party, started making out with the guy from the gym, and disappeared for a few hours. This was fairly typical of Anna, and something that I had come to love about her, namely that nothing ever went as planned. Something always happened. She was a nice reprieve from my own personality. A personality for whom everything went as planned and nothing ever happened. So, when I was stranded at the party waiting for Anna to pop out of wherever she'd been hiding, I wasn't angry or surprised. I had assumed things might take this turn. I was only slightly annoyed as I rang in the new year with a group of strangers. I stood there awkwardly as friends kissed each other and I just stared into my champagne glass. I didn't let it ruin my evening. I talked to some cool people that night. I made the best of it. I met a guy named Fabian, who was just finishing med school, but said his real passion was fine wine, fine food, and fine women. He winked at me as he said this, and as I gracefully removed myself from the conversation shortly thereafter, Fabian asked for my number. I gave it to him, and although he was cute, I knew that if he did call, I wouldn't answer. Fabian seemed like the kind of guy who would take me to an expensive bar on our first date. The kind of guy who would check out other girls while I was in the bathroom. That was the kind of guy who found victory in sleeping with you. It was a game to him, and I just never knew how to play it well. Anna, on the other hand, knew how to have fun. She met people. She flirted with them. She had whatever that thing is that makes men fawn over women and lose their own self-respect in the process. Anna had all the power in her romances. And while I could see the point in living like that, from an outside view, it never seemed very full of passion. It was calculated. I was waiting for someone that would sweep me off my feet and would be swept up by me in equal parts. I wanted someone who wouldn't want to play games because doing so meant less time being together. I wasn't sure if this person existed, but I was too young to give up on the idea. I finally found Anna asleep in the master bathroom. I picked her up and cabbed her home. By the time I reached my own apartment, it was about 2 a.m. and I was tired. The bottle of champagne intended for our beach rendezvous went unopened, and I got in bed. As I fell asleep that night, eyeliner not fully cleaned off my face, black sequined dress on the floor, I thought about what this year could bring. And my mind raced with all of the possibilities, however unlikely. But out of all the possibilities, I didn't think about being married by the end of May. I woke up New Year's Day alone in my apartment, just like I woke up every other day, and there was nothing in particular that seemed special about it. I read in bed for 2 hours. I took a shower. I got dressed. I met Anna for breakfast. I'd been up for about 3.5 hours by the time I saw her. She looked like she hadn't been up for 5 minutes. Anna is tall and lanky, with long brown hair that falls far beyond her shoulders and perfectly matches her golden brown eyes. She was born in Brazil and lived there until she was 13. And it's still noticeable every once in a while in some of her words, mostly her exclamations. Other than that, she is fully Americanized, assimilated, cleansed of all cultural identity. I'm pretty sure her name is supposed to be pronounced with a long A like Anna, but somewhere in middle school she gave up explaining the difference, and so now she's Anna. Anyway, anyone would like to pronounce it. That particular morning, she was wearing big sweatpants that didn't make her look fat because she was so skinny, and she had her hair pulled up into a ponytail. A zip-up sweatshirt covering her torso. You could barely tell she wasn't wearing a shirt underneath her sweatshirt, and it occurred to me that this is how Anna does it. This is how she drives men crazy. She looks naked while being entirely covered, and you would have absolutely no indication she does this on purpose. "Nice shirt," I said, as I pulled my sunglasses off and sat down across from her. Sometimes I worried that my own average body looked oversized compared to hers, that my own plain, all-American features only served to highlight how exotic she was. When I made jokes about it, she would remind me that I am a blonde woman in the United States. She'd say, "Blonde trumps everything." I've always thought of my hair as dirty blonde, almost mousy, but I saw her point. Even with how gorgeous Anna is, I've never heard her express satisfaction with her own looks. When I would say I didn't like my small boobs, she'd remind me that I have long legs and a butt she'd kill for. She'd always confess how much she hated her short eyelashes and knees, that her feet looked like troll feet. So maybe we're all in the same boat. Maybe all women feel like before photos. Anna had already made herself comfortable on the patio, having a muffin and an iced tea. She pretended like she was about to get up when I sat down, but just reached for a half hug.
Are you ready to kill me for last night?
What? I said as I pulled out the menu. I don't know why I even bothered to look at the menu. I ate Eggs Benedict every Saturday morning.
I don't even remember what happened, honestly. I just remember parts of the cab ride home and then you taking my shoes off before you pulled the covers over me.
I nodded. That sounds about right. I lost you for about 3 hours and found you in the upstairs bathroom, so I can't speak to how far you and that guy from the gym got, but I would imagine...
No, I hooked up with Jim.
I put the menu down. What? No, the guy from the gym.
Yeah, his name is Jim.
You met a guy at the gym named Jim?
Technically, this wasn't his fault. People named Jim should be allowed to go to gyms, but I couldn't shake the feeling this somehow made him ridiculous.
Is that a bran muffin? She nodded, so I took some of it.
You and I might be the only two people on the planet that like the taste of bran muffins, she said to me, and she might have been right.
Anna and I often found striking similarities in each other in meaningless places, the clearest one being food. It doesn't matter if you and another person both liked tzatziki. It has no bearing on your ability to get along. But somehow, in these overlaps of taste, there was a bond between Anna and me. I knew she was about to order the Eggs Benedict, too.
Anyway, I saw you making out with Jim from the gym, but I don't know what happened after that. Oh, well, I'm going to assume that it didn't get much further because he's already texted me this morning.
It's 11 a.m.
I know, I thought it was a bit quick, but it's flattering, she said.
What can I get for you two?
The waitress who came up to us wasn't our usual waitress. She was older, had been through more.
Oh, hi, I don't think we've met before. I'm Anna.
Daphne. This waitress wasn't nearly as interested in being friends with us as Anna might have hoped.
What happened to Kimberly? Anna asked.
Oh, not sure. Just filling in for the day.
Ah, okay, well, we'll make this easy on you. Two Eggs Benedict, and I'll have an iced tea like she has, I said.
You got it.
Once she left, Anna and I resumed our earlier discussion. I've been thinking about resolutions, Anna said, offering me some of her iced tea while I waited for mine to get there. I declined because I knew if I had some of hers, she'd take that as license to drink some of mine when it arrived, and she'd drink my whole damn glass. I'd known her long enough to know where to draw my boundaries and how to draw them so she wouldn't notice.
Okay, and?
I'm thinking something radical.
Radical? This should be good.
Celibacy.
Celibacy?
Celibacy, not having sex.
No, I know what it means. I'm just wondering why.
Oh, well, I came up with it this morning. I'm 26 years old, and last night I got drunk and can't be entirely sure if I slept with someone or not. That seems to be the closest to slut rock bottom that I want to get.
You are not a slut. I wasn't exactly sure if this was true.
No, you're right. I'm not a slut. Yet.
You could just stop drinking.
I had an interesting relationship with drinking in that I could take it or leave it. Drink, not drink, it did not matter to me. Most people I'd found so far fell strongly on one side or the other. Anna fell strongly on the drinking side. What are you talking about?
You know, stop getting drunk.
At all?
Stop it. I'm not saying something preposterous here. There are plenty of people that just don't drink.
Yeah, Elsie, they're called alcoholics.
I laughed. Fair enough. Drinking isn't the problem. It's the sleeping around.
Right, so I'm just going to stop sleeping around.
And what happens when you meet someone you really want to be with?
Well, I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. I didn't meet anyone last year worth my time. I can't say I expect that to change this year.
Daphne showed up with two Eggs Benedict and my iced tea. She put them down in front of us, and I didn't realize how hungry I'd been until the food was staring me in the face. I dug right in. Anna nodded, chewing. When it started to look like she could speak without spitting food, she added, I mean, if I meet someone and fall in love, sure, but until then, nobody's getting in here. She made an X in the air with her utensils. Fair enough. The best part about this place was they put spinach in the Eggs Benedict, kind of an Eggs Benedict Florentine. This doesn't mean I can't sleep around, though, right? I said to her. No, you still can. You won't, but you still can. Anna was soon on her way back to the other side of town. She was living in Santa Monica in a condo that overlooked the Pacific Ocean. I'd have been jealous enough to resent her if she hadn't offered on a regular basis for me to move in. I always declined, knowing that living with Anna might be the only thing that could teach me to dislike her. I never did understand how Anna could live the way she did on the salary of a part-time yoga teacher, but she always seemed to have enough money for the things she wanted and needed when she wanted and needed them. After she left, I walked back to my apartment. I knew exactly how I'd be spending my afternoon. It was a new year, and I always felt like a new year didn't feel new without rearranging the furniture. The problem was that I had rearranged my apartment so many times in the 2 years I'd lived there that I'd exhausted all rational possibilities. I loved my apartment and worked hard to afford it and decorate it. So as I moved the couch from wall to wall, ultimately realizing that it really looked best where it was originally, I was still satisfied. I moved the bookcase from one wall to another, switched my end tables, and decided this was enough of a change for me to commemorate the year. I sat down on the couch, turned on the television, and fell asleep. It was 5 p.m. when I woke up, and while it was technically a Saturday night and single people on Saturday nights are supposed to go out to bars or clubs and find a date, I opted to watch television, read a book, and order a pizza. Maybe this year was going to be the year I did whatever the hell I wanted, regardless of social norms. Maybe. When it started raining, I knew I'd been right to stay inside. Anna called a few hours later, asking what I was doing. I wanted to make sure you're not sitting on the couch watching television. What? Why can't I watch television? It's a Saturday night, Elsie. Get up. Go out. I'd say you should come out with me, but I'm going on a date with Jim. So much for celibacy. What? I'm not sleeping with him. I'm eating dinner with him. I laughed. Okay, well, I'm spending the night on my couch. I'm tired and sleepy, and tired and sleepy are the same thing. Stop making excuses. Fine, I'm lazy, and I like being alone sometimes. Good. At least you admitted it. I'll call you tomorrow. Wish me luck keeping it in my pants. You'll need it. Hey! Hey, I said back. Okay, I'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye. With a phone in my hand, I ordered a pizza. When I called Georgie's Pizza to order it, the woman on the phone told me it would be an hour and a half before it was delivered. When I asked why, all she said was, rain. I told her I'd be there in a half hour to pick it up. Walking into Georgie's Pizza, I felt nothing. No part of my brain or my body knew what was about to happen. I felt no premonition. I was wearing bright yellow galoshes and what can only be described as fat jeans. The rain had matted my hair to my face, and I'd given up pushing it away. I didn't even notice Ben sitting there. I was far too involved with the minutia of trying to buy a pizza. Once the cashier told me it would be another 10 minutes, I retired to the small bench in the front of the store, and it was then that I noticed there was another person in the same predicament. My heart didn't skip a beat. I had no idea he was it. It was he. He was the man I dreamed about as a child, wondering what my husband would look like. I was seeing this face I had wondered about my whole life, and it was right here in front of me, and I didn't recognize it. All I thought was, he'll probably get his pizza before I get mine. He looked handsome in a way that suggested he didn't realize just how handsome he was. There was no effort involved, no self-awareness. He was tall and lean with broad shoulders and strong arms. His jeans were just the right shade of blue. His shirt brought out the gray in his green eyes. They looked stark against his brown hair. I sat down next to him and swatted my hair away from my forehead again. I picked up my phone to check my email and otherwise distract myself from the waiting.
"Hi,"
he said. It took me a second to confirm he was, in fact, speaking to me. That easily, my interest was piqued. "Hi," I said back. I tried to let it hang there, but I was bad with silence. I had to fill it. "I should have just had it delivered."
"And miss all this?"
he said, referencing the tacky faux Italian decor with his hands. I laughed.
"You have a nice laugh," he said.
"Oh, stop it," I said. I swear, my mother taught me how to take a compliment, and yet each time I was given one, I shoot it away like it was on fire. I mean, thank you. That's what you're supposed to say. Thank you. I noticed that I had subconsciously shifted my entire body toward him. I'd read all of those articles about body language and pupil dilation when people are attracted to each other. But whenever I got into a situation where it was actually useful, are his pupils dilated? Does he like me? I was always far too unfocused to take advantage.
"No, what you're supposed to do is compliment me back," he said, smiling. "That way, I know where I stand."
"Ah," I said. "Well, it doesn't really tell you much if I compliment you now, does it? I mean, you know that I'm complimenting you because you've asked."
"Trust me, I can still tell."
"All right," I said, while I look him up and down. As I made a show of studying him, he stretched out his legs and lengthened his neck. He pulled his shoulders back and puffed out his chest. I admired the stubble on his cheeks, the way it made him look effortlessly handsome. My eyes felt drawn to the strength of his arms. What I wanted to say was, "You have great arms," and yet I didn't have it in me. I played it safe.
"So," he said.
"I like your shirt," I said to him. It was a heathered gray shirt with a bird on it.
"Oh,"
he said, and I could hear honest-to-God disappointment in his voice.
"I see how it is."
"What?" I smiled defensively. "That's a nice compliment." He laughed. He wasn't overly interested or desperate. He wasn't aloof or cool either. He just was. I don't know whether he was this way with all women, whether he was able to talk to any woman as if he'd known her for years, or whether it was just me. But it didn't matter. It was working.
"Oh, it's fine,"
he said.
"But I'm not even going to try for your number. Girl compliments your eyes, your hair, your beard, your arms, your name. That means she's open to a date. Girl compliments your shirt. You're getting shot down."
"Wait, that's not—" I started, but I was interrupted. "Ben Ross," the cashier called out, and he jumped up. He looked right at me and said,
"Hold that thought."
He paid for his pizza, thanked the cashier genuinely, and then came and sat right back down next to me on the bench.
"Anyway, I'm thinking if I ask you out, I'm going to be shot down. Am I going to be shot down?"
No, he was absolutely not going to be shot down. But I was now embarrassed and trying hard not to seem eager. I smiled wide at him, unable to keep the canary feathers in my mouth. "Your pizza is going to get cold," I told him. He waved me off.
"I'm over this pizza. Give it to me straight. Can I have your number?"
There it was. Do or die time. How to say it without screaming it with all of the nervous energy in my body? "You can have my number. It's only fair." "Elsie Porter," the cashier yelled. Apparently, she had been calling it for quite a while, but Ben and I were too distracted to hear much of anything. "Oh, sorry, that's me. Just wait here." He laughed, and I walked up to pay for my pizza. When I came back, he had his phone out. I gave him my number, and I took his.
"I'm going to call you soon, if that's okay. Or should I do the wait 3 days thing? Is that more your style?"
"No, go for it," I said, smiling. "The sooner the better." He put out his hand to shake, and I took it.
"Ben."
"Elsie," I said. And for the first time, I thought the name Ben sounded like the finest name I'd ever heard. I smiled at him. I couldn't help it. He smiled back and tapped his pizza.
Well, until then.
I nodded. Until then, I said. And I walked back to my car. Kitty.
June. I tear the Georgie's magnet off the refrigerator and try to rip it in half, but I can't get it to succumb to my weak fingers. It just bends and stretches. I realize the futility of what I'm doing, as if removing this magnet, destroying this magnet, will ease my pain in any way. I put it back on the refrigerator door and I dial Susan. She answers on the second ring.
Susan, hi, it's Elsie.
Hi, can you meet this afternoon to go over arrangements?
Arrangements?
I hadn't really thought about what Susan would want to talk about. Arrangements hadn't even occurred to me. Now, as I let it register, I realize that of course there are arrangements. There are things to plan, carefully calculated ways to grieve. You can't even mourn in peace. You must do it through American customs and civilities. The next few days will be full of obituaries and eulogies, coffins and caterers. I'm shocked she's even contemplating me being a part of them.
Sure, absolutely, I say, trying to inject some semblance of get up and go into my voice. Where should I meet you?
I'm staying at the Beverly Hotel, she says, and she tells me where it is, as if I haven't lived in Los Angeles for years.
Oh, I say, I didn't realize you were staying in town.
She lives 2 hours away. She can't at least stay in her own city? Leave this one to me? There's a lot to take care of, Elsie. We can meet at the bar downstairs.
Her voice is curt, uninterested, and cold. I tell her I will meet her there at 3. It's almost 1.
Whatever is convenient for you, she says, and gets off the phone. None of this is convenient for me. What would be convenient for me is to fall asleep and never wake up. That's what would be convenient for me. What would be convenient for me is to be at work right now because everything is fine and Ben will be home tonight for dinner around 7 and we're having tacos. That's convenient for me. Talking to the mother-in-law I met yesterday about funeral arrangements for my dead husband isn't convenient for me no matter what time it happens in the afternoon. I get back in bed, overwhelmed by everything I need to do before I meet with her. I'll need to shower, to get dressed, to get in the car, to drive, to park. It's too much. When Anna comes back, I'm in tears with gratitude because I know she will take care of everything. I arrive at the hotel a few minutes late. Anna goes to park the car and says she'll be in the lobby. She says to text her if I need her. I walk into the bar area and scan for Susan. It's cold in this bar, despite being warm outside. I hate air conditioning. I moved here to be warm. The room is brand new, but made to look old. There's a chalkboard menu behind the bar that's too clean to be from the era the decorator would like you to believe. The stools are reminiscent of a speakeasy, but they aren't cracked and worn. They look pristine and unused. This is the age we live in. We are able to have nostalgia for things made yesterday. I would have loved this bar last week, when I liked things cool and clean. Now, I hate it for being false and inauthentic. I finally spot Susan, sitting at a high table in the back. She is reading the menu, head down, hand covering her face. She glances up and spots me. As we look at each other for a moment, I can see that her eyes are swollen and red, but her face means business. Hi, I say as I sit down. She does not get up to greet me.
Hi, she says as she adjusts herself in her seat. I stopped by Ben's apartment last night to try to...
Ben's apartment?
Off Santa Monica Boulevard. I talked to his roommate, and he told me that Ben moved out last month.
Right, I say.
He said Ben moved in with a girl named Elsie.
That's me, I say,
excited by the prospect of her believing me.
I gathered as much, she says dryly.
Then she pulls a binder from the floor and puts it in front of me.
I received this from the funeral home. It's a list of options for the service.
Okay, I say.
Decisions will need to be made regarding flowers, the ceremony, the obituary, etc.
Sure. I don't entirely know what the etc. is. I've never been in this situation before.
I think it's best you tend to those duties.
Me? Yesterday, she didn't even believe I had a right to be at the hospital. Now she wants me to plan his funeral?
You don't want to have any input? I say, dubious.
No, I won't be joining you. I think it's best if you take care of this yourself. You want to be his next of kin.
She trails off. But I know how she was going to end it. She was going to say, you want to be his next of kin, you got it. I ignored her attitude and tried to keep Ben, my Ben, her Ben, our Ben, in mind.
But his family should be involved.
I am the only family Ben has, Elsie. Had. I am all he had.
I know, I just meant, you should be involved in this. We should do this together.
She is quiet as she gives me a tight and rueful smile. She looks down at the utensils on the table. She plays with the napkins and salt shaker.
Ben clearly did not want me involved in his life. I don't see why I should be intimately involved in his death.
Why would you say that?
I just told you, she says. He clearly did not care enough to tell me he was getting married or moving in with you or whatever you two were to each other. And I...
She wipes a tear away with a tissue, delicately and with purpose.
She shakes her head to clear it. Elsie, I don't care to discuss this with you. You have a list of things to do. All I ask is that you inform me as to when the service will be and what will be done with his ashes.
Ben wanted to be buried, I say. He told me he wanted to be buried in sweatpants and a t-shirt so he'd be comfortable.
At the time, when he told me, I thought this was sweet. It didn't occur to me that I wouldn't be senile by the time he passed away, that it would be within months of that very conversation.
Her face scrunches itself around her eyes and mouth, and I can tell she's mad.
The lines around her mouth become pronounced, and for the first time I can see evidence that she is an older woman. Does my mom have these lines? It's been so long since I've seen her, I don't know.
Maybe Susan doesn't realize what she's doing.
Maybe she thinks she's strong enough to cut off her nose to spite her face here, to give me this funeral arranging as a punishment. But she's not. And she's already bothered.
Everyone in our family has been cremated, Elsie. I never heard Ben say he wanted otherwise. Just tell me what is going to be done with the ashes.
She looks down at the table and sighs, blowing air out of her mouth and onto her lap.
I should be going.
She gets up from the table and leaves, not looking back at me, not acknowledging my existence.
I grab the binder and head toward the lobby, where Anna is waiting patiently. She drives us home, and I walk right up the front steps to my door. When I realize I've left my keys inside, I turn around and start crying. Anna soothes me as she pulls my spare key off her keyring and hands it to me. She hands it to me as if it will make everything okay. As if the only reason I'm crying is I can't get into the apartment.
January. I woke up in the morning after meeting Ben to a text message from him.
Rise and shine, Elsie Porter. Can I take you to lunch?
I jumped out of bed, shrieked like an idiot, and hopped in place compulsively for at least 10 seconds. There was so much energy in my body, I had no other way of getting it out.
Sure, where to? I texted back. I stared at the phone until it lit up again.
I'll come pick you up, 12:30. What's your address?
I sent him my address, and then ran into the shower as if it was urgent. But it wasn't urgent.
I was ready to go by 11:45, and I felt entirely pathetic about that. I put my hair up in a high ponytail and shimmied into my favorite jeans and most flattering t-shirt. Sitting around my house for 45 minutes dressed and ready to go made me feel silly, so I decided to get out of my house and go for a walk. And in all of my glee and excitement, I locked myself out. My heart started beating so fast I couldn't think straight. I'd left everything inside, my phone, my wallet. Anna had my spare key, but that wasn't going to do me much good without a phone to call her. I walked up and down the street looking for change so that I could ultimately call her on a payphone. But it turns out people don't really leave quarters on the ground. You'd think they would because quarters are small and sort of meaningless most of the time, but when you really need one, you realize just how ubiquitous they aren't. Then I decided to find a payphone anyway, since maybe I could rig it to call for free, or there'd be a quarter stuck in the little change box. After scouring the neighborhood, I couldn't find a single one, which left me no viable option I could think of other than breaking into my own apartment. So that's what I tried to do. I was on the second story of a duplex, but you could kind of get to the patio from the front stairs. So I walked up the stairs, climbed onto the railing, and tried to grab onto the rail of my patio. If I could get my hand on it and swing a leg around, I was pretty confident I could get onto the patio without much chance of falling to my death. From there, it was just a matter of crawling through the little doggy door in the screen that had been put there by the tenants before me. I had hated that damn doggy door until that very moment, when I was convinced it was my salvation. As I continued my attempts to grab onto the patio rail, I realized that this might actually be an incredibly stupid plan, in which I was sure to be injured. If it was taking me this long to grab the rail in the first place, why on earth did I think I could easily swing my leg onto it once I reached it? I made one final and valiant effort to grab on before I got the cuckamamie idea that it was best to go leg first. I was leg first when Ben found me.
Elsie?
Ah! I almost lost my footing, but I managed to get my leg back onto the steps, only slightly falling over in the process. I caught myself. Hi, Ben! I ran down the steps and hugged him. He was laughing.
What you doing there?
I was embarrassed, but somehow not in any threatening way. I was trying to break into my own apartment. I locked myself out without a phone or a wallet or anything.
You don't have a spare key?
I shook my head. No, I did at one point, but then it seemed smarter somehow for me to give it to my friend Anna, so she had it in case of emergency. He laughed again. It didn't feel like he was laughing at me, although I think technically he was.
Got it. Well, what do you want to do? You can call Anna from my phone now if you want, or we can go get lunch and then you can call her when we get back.
I started to answer, but he cut me off.
Or I'm also happy to break into your house for you, if you haven't given up on that idea yet.
Do you think you can swing your leg over this rail onto that one? I said. I was joking, but he wasn't.
Absolutely I can.
No, stop, I was kidding. We should go get lunch. Ben started taking off his jacket.
No, I insist you let me do this. It will look brave of me. I'll be considered a hero.
He walked closer to the rail and judged the distance.
That's actually quite far. You were going to try to do that?
I nodded. But I have little regard for my own safety, I said. And a very bad sense of distance. Ben nodded.
Okay, I'm going to jump this thing, but you have to make me a promise.
Okay, you got it.
If I fall and hurt myself, you won't let them call my emergency contact.
I laughed. Why is that?
Because that's my mother, and I blew her off for lunch today so I could see you.
You blew off your mom for me?
See, it doesn't make you look very good either, letting me do it. So, do we have an agreement?
I nodded firmly. You got it. I put out my hand to shake. He looked me in the eye and dramatically shook it, as a smile crept back onto his face.